So I'd like to thank Alan for inviting me. It's been a pleasure to be here to talk immunology and to see the sun again, because we don't see that in England at this time of year. So I'm going to talk about modelling, some modelling of the immunological synapse. I originally did the model with Christoph Wolfing. I'm going to show you some stuff on some sharp interface models with Julian Scalerian, and I'm going to show you, if time permits, some images and some analysis we'll be doing with Dan Davis and Leo Carlin. So, I thought first of all I'd run through the key observations here, just to remind us what we're talking about. So the key observations is, as Dan did beautifully this morning, you've got the interface depth correlates with bond length. And that's the model I'm going to look at throughout this talk. There is another one to do with rafts, but we're not mentioning rafts apparently. So just to remind you, the TCR MHC, this is a major histopathology complex which holds the peptide. The TCR is the antigen receptor. And there's other ones which people have used. There's this co-receptor CD2, which I'm going to mention, with its ligand CD48 on the APC. And another one I'm going to mention is the natural killer cell receptor, which binds the MHC, which is also around 14 nanometers. Then you've got the adhesion molecules, LFA1 and ICAM1, it's about 41 nanometers. And then these guys, which are big. So large molecules tend to be excluded from the interface. And so one of the points I want to make is that segregation and central aggregation are distinct events.
Okay, so immunologists love to number all their cell surface molecules, and they call the CD and give them a number, and they're up to about 150. And then you'd be flipping a little periodic table on your wall to figure out what they're really talking about. But anything that's a CD with a number is a cell surface molecule.
Stop. Good. Okay, so this is one of the, this is from Dustin's lab from about 4 years ago. And what you're actually looking at is on the lipid bilayer, you're looking on the lipid bilayer, and you've got, this is the CD45, so it's basically outlining the cell because it's shoved out of the contact interface. And then inside, on the lipid bilayer, is green, which is the MHC molecule, and red, which is the TCR. And then the overlay.
This is the T cell.
Yeah.
T cell.
This is
the
T cell.
On the plane with some sort of peptide, and did you mark that was all that was on it, or
a T cell? It's got LFA, it will have ICAM1. And MHC. So they're not visualizing the ICAM1. They're looking at the TCR. So this is its ligand, and that's its receptor, and this is the initial condition. And then our. So what you see over about 30 minutes is, first of all, some small clustering, and then the aggregation. So it quickly aggregates within a couple of minutes.
And so it's sticking to a bilayer.
It's on a glass.
So on the glass is moving.
Yeah, it will freely diffuse. Yeah.
How does it move across the glass?
It's in a bilayer.
Oh, right. It is a bilayer.
Well, it's on a monolayer, I think. I don't think it's bilayer. So this is so I'm going to switch molecules on you. It doesn't really matter for the purposes of this talk. They're short. Okay, so we've always got short and a long, no matter what we look at. So this is the interference reflective microscopy. This is depth. And this is, so the top three panels, this is labeling the two ligands in the on the glass slide on the monolayer. You've got CD48 and ICAM1. Okay, and the observation is that they're spatially segregated. Okay, and this is also aggregated in the middle, this guy. There's actually a bar down here. So 10 microns is about this. So these cells are huge. This is a cancer cell line which transfected with CD2 in this case. And here there's a CD2, and there's a portion on the CD2 which recruits an adapter molecule called CD2 adapter molecule, and that signals to the cytoskeleton. And here, that binding has been disrupted, so you don't get cytoskeletal signaling in this case. And so in this case, you get the segregation, okay, but you do not get the central aggregation. So basically, in the rest of this talk, we're going to be talking about this case, where there's no cytoskeletal involvement. So you could think about it as this sort of this system with the mutant CD2, or some people. So there are other systems where the cytoskeletal involvement is either zero or less. I mean, it's still controversial. So I'm just going to list the physical processes which I want to put into a model. So membrane elasticity, we're talking about membranes. We've got to bear in mind surface tension and rigidity. We're talking about forming bonds between two membranes, which can be a variable separation. So you've got to bring in this bond stretching. So Dan discussed this morning. There's rafts, which we're not mentioning. There's thermal fluctuations, of course, so this is noise. And this is just to emphasize the role of entropy in the system. I'm going to write down PDEs. So what we're talking about is diffusion. And diffusion will tend to homogenize all the molecules. So when you get segregation, you've incurred a cost. And so what we're really looking for is a place where we can pay that cost. Okay, rafts. I'd prefer not. Maybe we can talk about them at the end. I'll mention them at the end. So this is the basic idea. It's a very, very simple idea. All of the models are basically using this idea. So if you've got a random distribution, basically a uniform distribution of your long and your short molecules, then you'll tend to form bonds only when, okay, this is the thing you have to analyze, but supposing they only form bonds when the membranes are about the right separation, then you won't form many bonds here. Okay? Whereas if you segregate them and you have regions where it's short and regions where it's long, then you will get a lot more bond formation, and therefore you'll be able to pay this segregation cost. So implicit in this is the fact that you can't form bonds at any arbitrary separation. And that's the thing which I'm going to show you how to analyze. So the model, I just modeled two receptor ligand pairs. They're identical in all respects, except for the two bond lengths. So I'm just making them identical, just to make it simple. And most of the rate constants do fit that category. The cell membrane's elastic, and the elasticity. Okay, the elasticity is determined by the surface tension. This is the bond elasticity, so I will mention that. So this is the bonds are treated as elastic springs. So we have a free energy of a bond, and we just we linearized about the natural bond length. So you just pick up a quadratic term, and so it's a very simple expansion. So this is our spring constant, kappa, and I claim that basically it's of the order of the surface tension. It's some constant times surface tension. And the reason I claim that is that if you think about forming a bond with long molecules, you've got to think about which is the most flexible component. You've got them sitting in a membrane. You could try and squash the protein themselves, or you could try and squash the bond itself. But the membrane is by far the most flexible component, so that will determine this kappa. So it then gets more difficult to actually determine the exact relationship between this kappa and this tension. So in fact, you can the surface tension on I think it was a neutrophil measurement I used was about 20 micronewtons per meter, and estimate kappa was somewhere between about 10 and 500. So it's quite a wide range, but it's basically determined by the properties of the cell. Yeah, it's a function of both, but primarily it's got a leading term, which is the surface tension, and multiplied by a factor, which is a log of the characteristic length of the membrane, which brings in the rigidity. You can't measure this. Yeah. Yeah, they tend to be the wrong order, because you're pulling a macroscopic thing. So you've got you've got to go careful. It depends whether you're pulling on the cytoskeleton as well. Perhaps we can talk about that. I did look at that data, and some of them were very big, and so there was something else going on there. Okay, so the reactions which I have, I've got the MHC, and I've switched systems on you. Now this is a natural killer cell, so this is the natural killer inhibitory receptor. These are our short guys, and we got complex formation, and this is the on and off rates, which are dependent on the local separation of the membranes. And then we got our adhesion molecules, ICAM1, LFA1. So I'm going to run through the model, and then I'm going to show you another model. So when we do our free energy expansion in our stretched bonds, we then get this Gaussian dependence of the affinity, and I've separated up here. It's not quite so well supported experimentally to separate it up like this. But in the end, it's not going to make much difference, because the actual bond kinetics are very fast compared to the other time scales we're interested in. So we will basically be able to do a local thermodynamic equilibrium. So the membrane is an elastic sheet, and I assume it's under very strong damping. So we get this expression here, this term here. M is the damping coefficient. And then we've got all the forces. We've got complexes, the bonds, which are under some sort of stretch or compression, are putting a force on your membrane and either contracting or expand, trying to push them apart, depending on the natural bond length. Glycocalyx potential, which actually isn't very important in what I'm going to say, because once you put in thermal noise and cytoskeletal noise, then this really isn't very important. And then you've got your rigidity term and your surface tension. We've got our three equations for our molecular species. We've got the receptors, Ri, so I runs from 1 to 2. So these are quite simple, basic reaction diffusion equations. You've got diffusion and reaction. The only term which is of interest is really this one in the complex, because if the membrane separation is in a gradient and you've formed a bond down here and it wants to be longer, it will shift, move up the gradient. And this is this term here. And the coefficient comes from an application of the Einstein relation between mobility and diffusion. So, under realistic parameters, you get some spontaneous segregation. So at t equals 0, I put some thermal fluctuations in the membrane. And this is sequential time. This is in 1D. So this is sequential time shots on top of each other. So you can see over 40 seconds, the membrane widens here, the separation widens, and you get this ligand 1, which is short, is moving out. And this is in 2D. This is 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and 5 minutes. So you can see the formation of the bonds, and they, after this, the dynamics is a lot slower. So the initial dynamics is extremely fast, within seconds, and then over the course of a couple of minutes, you get some immediate coalescence of some domains, but after it settles down, this will stay there for a very long time. It will be very, very slow. It will continue to coarsen, but it will be very slow. So one of the things I want to talk about is how fast this coarsening will happen.
So what's the scale for this?
This would be 10 microns. So I'm thinking of modelling the middle part of the contact interface. So this model doesn't include other part, the rest of the cell. It doesn't include incoming flux from the rest of the cell. So it's just meant to be a study of segregation.
Surface tension
fixed.
Yes. So it's fixed, it's like a stretch
a bit of boundaries. You have
your
hand.
It's like you have some kind of stretching happening.
Why would it stretch?
Not stretch, you're going. There is a surface
tension. Yeah, there is a surface tension. Okay, so let's try and.
Do you know why the sausages are not round?
It will be because of the spatial correlations in the membrane fluctuations. If you do it with the fluctuations in the membrane are a lot better at forming domains than if you put your fluctuations in your concentrations of your molecules. Because the membrane has a correlation length.
Aren't you looking down on the membrane?
Yeah, yeah. But it's so height fluctuations.
The question is, why is there...
It's just random. It's just random.
But would that eventually heal?
No, you say it's not random.
It's coarsening slowly.
Yeah, and eventually, if you waited long enough, which... Well, I didn't numerically do it for long enough.
Eventually, presumably, you would just get one black.
Yeah.
That wasn't my question. Why is it in the form of stripes, elongated stripes?
It's because of the fluctuations. You've just got... I mean, sometimes you get... you don't believe that. Because I interpret that as the fact that when you've got fluctuations in the membrane, you've got a correlation... a correlation, spatial correlation in those fluctuations. But maybe we can talk about that. Because that's the one thing I haven't been able to analyze is how you seed those domains and the patterns you will get.
Do you use the gamma to be your surface, the membrane surface in the
previous
calculation?
Did I?
Yeah, did you use spring constant?
No. I think I chose that. I will show you. I'll show you. Okay. So bifurcation analysis. Okay. Segregation requires an effective elasticity. This is this kappa for the bond length larger than 23 micronewtons per meter. So this depends on the other parameters, of course. But so what I'm going to do is show you bifurcation plots as a vary this kappa, because this kappa is a thing which I think is the most interesting parameter in the system. So this says if bond stretching is very cheap, then it doesn't matter where you're not going to segregate, because no matter what the separation is, you're still going to be able to form a bond. It's just not going to make any difference. So it's got to be expensive enough, and expensive enough in this context means 23 micronewtons per meter. So this is a bifurcation plot. This is a homogeneous, this is without space, and this is the stability of the separation. So as I said I assumed that the two receptor ligand systems were identical. So that's why this is right in the middle. And then you've got your 41 and your 14, which is your short, long and your short. So when the bond elasticity is short, is low, it's the average bond length which is stable. And then if it's larger than this, which is about 69, then it's the, you get the a bifurcation to short and long. If you put a glycocalyx in, you get another bifurcation much further up. So where did 23 come in? That's way down here. That's because you have to think about spatial instability. So this is thinking about it as a plotting kappa. This is a 23, where the average separation becomes unstable to spatially inhomogeneous fluctuations. So this is like diffusion-driven instability. So very low, below 23, you've got one depth. Here, all you get is a pattern. Above this, where the average state becomes unstable to homogeneous perturbations, you get long and short, and then you can go through the other bifurcations. And so this is 23, that's about 60, so I think kappa is somewhere in here. Okay. So let's move on. We've got a PDE model. What we'd like to do is some analysis on it. But we need to look for some ideas, and so I'm going to take a different approach now. So what we know is that fluctuations are seeding domains, and what we'd like to know is things about domain areas, the domain statistics, their stability and their dynamics. So we have coarsening, so we have reshaping, we have growth of domains, we have decay of domains, and we have coalescence of domains. So what can we say about any of this system? So there is definitely a separation of timescales. Domains form very rapidly, and then they undergo very slow coarsening. So this suggests that we should look at a sharp interface model or a moving boundary approximation. And so we'd like to write down the free energy of the system as an integration over the contour of a line energy plus some things which depend on the local nature of the contour. So R here would be the local radius, which would be, so this would be including the local curvature. So what I'm going to do is write down a thermodynamic model, so it's very similar to what Dan and Byron have been doing. And then I'm going to use it for domain analysis. So you've seen this already, we've got a chemical. So I'm going to simplify the situation just to get some ideas, and then I'm going to move to the situation I'm interested in. So let's just consider one single reaction, receptor ligand making a complex, and we've got two parts to our system. We've got two compartments which it can sit in, and we have a chemical potential of species I in region J. So this is where the entropy comes in, and this is the standardized chemical potential, and the standardized chemical potential is different for the complex in the two compartments. And in this case we're thinking about the shift, the change in the chemical potential because of the formation of bonds. And so this would be our change in our free energy. So we just have to find the thermodynamic minimum. So we just have to write down all the reactions and minimize our free energy. So just for those that might not have done this before or did it a long time ago, we have our free energy. This is the sum of all our molecular species over all our compartments, of the chemical potentials times the number of molecules. And these are all the different reactions. This is reacting in compartment 1, receptor and ligand form a complex in compartment 2, and this is transfer. So you just get what you thought you'd get. You get that the chemical potentials across the two compartments must all be equal. So for this, it just implies the receptor concentration must be equal in the two compartments. The ligand concentration must be equal in two compartments, and the complex concentration must differ by this Boltzmann factor. And then this Boltzmann factor also comes in when you calculate the the affinity into two compartments.
So the long bonds can go into the short area.
Yeah. What do you mean?
Long bonds. The long receptors can go into the short.
Free diffusion. Yeah. Okay, so why did I do that? Well, I want to actually consider another degree of freedom. I want to change the proportion of the area between the two compartments. And you do this, and you just get out that for thermodynamic equilibrium, the complex concentration must be equal. So this is inconsistent with what I did before. So there's no non-trivial solution. The compartment with the highest complex concentration just wins. So it's all a bit trivial in this simple case. So now let's make it more complicated. What we're interested in is short bonds and long bonds. So now we have two types of domains, one where the concentration of the short bonds is high and one where the concentration of the long bonds is high. So you do the same thing, and the sum of the concentrations must be equal across the two domains. Okay, so this is something we haven't seen before. We didn't get it in the PDE. So we can go and look where it should be, whether we can reproduce it in our PDE. We can think of this as a balance of pressures. This is just changing the area and getting the thermodynamic equilibrium in the area. So the area will change until this is satisfied. So it must be true in yours. In 2D, we got an additional contribution to the free energy. So we have to sum over the contour. And when you do that, you get an extra contribution from the wall. So this means that this is no longer true, but there's a correction because of the... so this is the radius, so it's, you can think of it as a curvature correction. So let's just concentrate on this again. This says that in domain 1, the sum of the complex concentrations must equal the sum of the complex concentrations in domain 2 plus this correction coming from the wall. So now we can really use that to get a long way. It's a very simple observation, which gives us a lot. Because what we also know is that the receptors and ligands freely diffuse through both domains. So they're uniform, and so therefore the complex concentrations in all of your domains of a given type must be equal. So the only way they're differing is because of that contribution from the wall. And the contribution from the wall was dependent on its radius. And so this equation can only work at one value of the radius. So we know the equilibrium configuration is a circle, and so now we know that only one circle can survive, and smaller ones will die and bigger ones will grow. There's something else we can get out of this. We can think about an invasion in an average bond length. And because of the cost of the wall, the domain has to be of a certain size before it will grow. So very small domains will not grow. They will collapse because the domain wall is too expensive. In the bifurcation analysis, I got the same result, which I didn't mention. There was a smallest wavelength which was unstable. Okay, so I've shown you two models. And now I'd like to relate them. I'd like to derive the sharp interface model from the PDE. It's very traditional to do this in physics. And there's, what I'm going to show you is actually hiding quite a lot of the perturbation theory and the technical difficulties. So what we're looking for is a stationary front solution in our PDE. That's really what we're looking for. And this is really a travelling wave velocity equal to zero. I'm not going to deal with the PDE system in its entirety. I'm going to simplify it. I'm going to assume that the complexes diffuse, the receptors, ligands, and complexes diffuse very rapidly, which is well justified given how slow the domains actually change. And if you do that, you can, the complex concentration is just a function of, comes into local equilibrium, thermodynamic equilibrium with the membrane separation. This is just the Boltzmann factor. And so we get this simplification. One variable, which is much easier to deal with. And we've just got this potential function now, which is it's a double potential well for this kappa is actually the same for both receptor ligand systems because it's determined by the properties of the cell. So this is a double potential well under quite under certain parameter regimes. Okay, so if you search for a traveling wave solution, you can figure out, fairly easy to do, that the velocity is given by this expression in one dimension. So this just says that for it to be stationary, that the value of the potential at the two extremes must be equal. And if we work out what that is, that's the sum of the complexes must be equal. So we've reproduced our condition from our thermodynamic analysis. So now, once we've worked out this stationary profile, we can stick it in our Hamiltonian and work out what sigma is, and we can also redo the same thing in polar coordinates and figure out increasing dependence on the curvature. So there's one caveat in that it's not possible, at least I haven't been able to do it, and I don't think Dan managed to do it, was to find an exact solution for the profile wave. But you can do a perturbative expansion, and you get this form. It's got, because of the equality of the sum of the complexes, it's actually symmetric, or very close to symmetric. And it's got two exponentials in it, so you've got two lengths in this profile. What one notices, so one thing which we're interested in is how sharp is this profile, because I've been using a sharp interface approximation. We'd like to know it's actually quite sharp, so you can figure out that it's not sharper than the characteristic lengths of the membrane. So I work using estimates for B and T, the surface tension. This characteristic length I estimated to be about 50 nanometers. So Chakrabarty, he used dictyostelium values, and he came up with about half a micron. So he would only ever see one domain in a conduct interface, whereas in my simulations I can get lots of them, because my width is short, very narrow compared to his. So a very common thing to try and do for sharp interfaces is to try and figure out how they move. And it's in most cases it's driven by the local curvature. So what I'm going to show you now is that that is true in our system as well. So this, I don't know what I was doing when I wrote down this proof, but the answer's right. It's actually a bit more difficult to do it, but let me just run through it. So we define ZA as a solution to this. This is slightly different. I've got some other terms here. A is going to be this local surface curvature. I'm using kappa in two ways. I apologize for that. But kappa is normally a spring constant, and kappa is also a local curvature. So this is meeting too many fields at the same time. So kappa in these slides is now local curvature. So you can think of that as 1 over the local radius if you Okay, so this is our equation. I've added these two terms. So we, I will show you in a moment. And then you can do the same thing. All you do is multiply by dz by the x and integrate. And these even terms disappear because they're boundary terms. And so this is the velocity. And what you've got, this is the term we had before. And now we've added a term proportional to a, which is going to be the local curvature. So this would be a curvature correction to our velocity. So now how do you normally do sharp interface analysis? Well, we know what the profile is, so we impose that, and what you say is that locally it looks like a sharp, this profile in 1D, and in the tangent direction going along the contour, it's very slowly changing. So it's a sharp interface approximation, and so you can impose this profile. Of course, this is slightly modified because I have a slightly modified equation, but that's the one you get. And it's A was equal to kappa. And this is a moving profile in a moving coordinate frame, u minus vt, and we're interested in the velocity. So as long as the curvature is moving quite so the curvature is basically 1 over the radius, and the radius r dot is basically v. So kappa dot is kappa cubed, and that's small. So if you do this and work out so if you stick in this ansatz, you'll get the previous equation. So this means that the velocity, as I said, the velocity has a curvature correction which is related to that line energy contribution which I talked about. So what we'd like to do now is just utilize this. We would like to have a circular domain, and so now you can work out what this correction was to this equality of the sums of the complex concentrations. We also have curvature-driven flow, as I said, and we can work out what the coefficient is. So now from this we can try and we can estimate some aspects of coarsening. So now we can work out how fast domains of a certain size will collapse or grow, and we can also go a bit further and estimate the rates of shape change by using the sharp interface Hamiltonian. The one thing which is much more difficult is the coalescence rate. Okay, so I've shown you two models. And I'd like to shift gears a bit now. I'd like to show you some what we're trying to do with the data analysis. And to some extent,
Since you're shifting off the model, could I just ask a question that's bothering me? These have very much the flavor of spinel decomposition. And in fact, Lipschitz's Flusser-Sock theory. Isn't it very similar to that?
I don't know which. I'm not familiar with these. I was following the Alan Kahn type approach.
Okay, I mean, but the late stages, you get it, which is close enough. So
I think it is. That's the late. He's not really looking particularly at the latest.
No, right. But when you were talking about, you know, the big things growing at the expense of the little ones, that there's a scaling law for that, which is well understood.
Is that?
Maybe we can talk about
that. Yeah. So one of the reasons which I was interested in sharp interfaces is because when you look at these, this is actually MHC fluorescence at a contact interface. I put the little crosses where the edge of the interface is. So this domain is sitting right inside the interface. So here's another one. This is a very good one, you see. It's nearly got thermodynamic minimum. It's nearly circular. And this is just showing it slightly differently. So let me just switch to a different...
This is data then.
Yeah, these are NK synapses. Just showing... this is a set of stacks. This is a set of stacks of images. And what you can see, for example, is here is the edge of the interface. So it's basically because we've double stained. This is the green is the MHC, and this is a lipid stain, so we can see both cells. Okay, and this is the way I analyze them. I'm not sure I'd do it again. It's been very, very painful. So on each slice, I locate the edge of the interface by working out the local tangent.
What?
Working out the local direction of the interface, the local tangent. And just to show that it's quite good, this is showing the normal to the interface. I'm sure this is coming out in black. On my screen, it's white. But when it's converted to PDF, for some reason it turns black. And this is when things are a bit more difficult. You can see these ruffles, and they are not captured by my algorithm. And I don't know of an algorithm that could do it. I mean, this is just speckles up here. I mean, what on earth does it look like? If you could, I mean, it's the resolution just isn't good enough.
So what could you explain? This is. What is being imaged here?
Ah, okay. Sorry. I've got two cells. I've got an NK cell, and it's forming a synapse with an APC. This is two cells. It's a cell-cell contact, not a cell on a surface. Cell on the surface, you could image directly the surface. When you image this, you take slices across it with a laser, so you can see each slice. And then you have to reconstruct by you just have to reconstruct the image. So basically you can see z-planes, and you want to see an xy interface, a zy interface. So you have to spin your images around. So you have to reconstruct the face you're interested in. So this is the z-plane which you're looking at. And actually the interface which I'm interested in... This is Z going up, and you actually want to look that direction, but you can only take slices that way.
You mean constant
Z? Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
The X Y plane.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you want to reconstruct from that some Z X.
Yeah. Z Y. Yeah. Yeah. So this is just a typical Z plane. You've got the MHC, this is your, it's actually a B cell. These are your NK cells. So these fit together. And the interesting parts of the data is these little bits down here. Okay, so this was a cell. So actually there's a 3D reconstruction of three synapses. These twirls are to do with putting the slices together, and I haven't corrected it yet, but because this is basically the projection which we're interested in, one of the synapses, and we don't get the swirls here, so don't worry about the swirls. But I did like the... Is it there? Yeah. So you can see three synapses on the three faces. So this is another one.
And the colors?
Oh, this is false colouring. False colouring, yeah. It's concentration. Concentration. Concentration of the MHC. So this is about a factor of 5 between red and blue.
And what's the scale?
This will be a pixel. You see, Dan originally did it with this pixel of about 200 nanometers separation, but I don't believe that he can actually resolve to that. So this is 600 nanometers. This height here would be, about 600 nanometers. This is perhaps a micron, or two, three microns. Oh, another one. Oh, we're getting a bit boring now. Okay, so what did I want to show you? Okay, so there's a question earlier about ruffles. Do they disappear in the interface? And I would claim that they do go away, because this is a plot. Because I've constructed the 3D shape and I've run through normally on a normal direction, I can look at the intensity as I go through, so I can get a width measurement and a intensity measurement. And this is what's plotted here. This is the standard deviation of that profile versus the intensity. And this population here is the one which is the enriched region. So it's got lower standard deviation than other parts which are outside the interface. So I think I have another image somewhere. So this was just another reconstruction of this guy sitting here, and you can see the single enrichment region. So if I just switch back.
How many slices are you using to do the
reconstruction? About 50. So, image analysis, what can we say about it? This is basically running through the simple observations you can do. So you can do the fluorescence change across the interface from one domain to another. And this tells you, so we're measuring MHC, so this tells you something about the receptor concentration versus its dissociation constant. And the jump is about factor of 5. Or you can reinterpret this and say the MHC in that MHC-rich domain is bound for about 75% of the time. You can also look at the domain fluorescence wall width, and it's about somewhere between a tenth and half a micron. But you've got to bear in mind that it maps through this concentration, this complex concentration.
So wall width, you mean the width of the interface?
No, we want the width of the interface. This is the width of a fluorescence image. And so the width of the interface is in here, now Z, and it's mapping through into our fluorescence by this mapping. So you'd have to undo that. So just to emphasize this, you see on the images Dan's done so far, he's only got the MHC, so we're now doing the other one, the ICAM1, just to see how where they sit. So if they look like this, then you're going to get a good fit of Z, because you've basically got these two Gaussian curvatures on Z. So you get a good reconstruction of Z. If it's like this, you're going to be able to do that tail, that part of it up there, and that part of it there, but you're going to be missing stuff in the middle. So at the moment we have to wait, I have to wait and find out which one it is. The other thing which I mentioned with this was this balance of the complex concentrations. Can we use that? Well, certainly we could in an artificial system on a bilayer, because you've labeled everything on the bilayer. So you know everything, you know all the ligands on the bilayer. And so you could use that formula as an observable. But there really aren't any other simple observables. So this is just to show you how sharp it is. So this is one of those synapses. This is going through lengths on the surface. So this is in pixels, I think. I think this is in pixels. You see, so this is in the rich domain, the MHC rich domain. This is in the rest of it. And it really does have a massive jump. I mean, you don't have to worry about noise in the system. it really is very significant. And it's actually very sharp here.
But that's the length scale?
This will be about a micron across. This one will be about a micron across. Maybe actually it must be bigger than that. It must be a couple of microns.
Okay.
So I will not run through that.
Sorry, because you've been looking at it all in terms of intensity. You're also looking at a preview which say you can tell it's totally flat. The question I asked before about ruffles is actually where?
The ruffles are smaller than people. Ruffles. Well, because I did the 3D reconstruction, you can compute the curvature. So it's somewhere here. Okay, there's a curvature computation. It's extremely noisy because it's having trouble locating exactly where the membrane is. So any small noise is going to cause a problem. But this is a curvature calculation. And the curvature you'd expect to be about 1 in 10 or something for the cell. So you can see very low curvature here and much higher curvature up at the edge. And this is the intensity picture. Now that's the standard deviation picture. So this was, again, what I said, the standard deviation is a lot lower in the domain. So it must be an intensity image. Oh, this is the intensity image. So you see there's a correlation between very low curvature and high intensity. I did actually have a movie somewhere. There must be a movie on the curvature somewhere. Yeah, here's a synapse showing you those three, where it's, the line was for reference, and this is the curvature picture. So I think it would be nice to be able to say that the ruffling is a lot less. And I think that's probably true. In the conduct interface, there are no ruffles. And I think there was a paper 3 years ago or something saying when they did the EMs, they didn't see many ruffles either. So conclusions. So I've been talking about segregation and segregation models. And so there are quite a few now. There's PDE model, there's thermodynamic model of Dan and Byron and Carla. And I've just added a sharp interface model. And I think they all agree. Other people have also done a lattice model. And they all can explain segregation. So I don't think we have a problem with explaining segregation. Segregation in the system, I think, at least under this driven by a difference in the bond length, is extremely well understood. What isn't understood is the role of signaling in this process. This is extremely difficult. And, for example, just to emphasize this, okay, we have spontaneous segregation. Okay? But what does that mean? Because experimentally we know that if you put a T cell against an APC which hasn't been pulsed, you don't see any segregation. When you pulse it, you do see segregation. So this is the antigen-presenting cell, and pulsing means that you mix. Your T cell is going to be specific to a particular peptide, which is got to be held in the MHC for the T cell receptor to see it. And what you can do on the APC, not all the MHC is filled with anything. Sometimes it gets on the surface and it's empty. So you can fill it artificially by just putting in the peptide, washing it with it for a couple of hours, and then taking your cells out, washing them, and then they've got this peptide which the T cell receptor is specific to on its surface. So you can turn an APC which wasn't being recognized to one which is in a very controlled manner. And what you see is that without any, you don't get segregation. And then you just have to add a little bit. It's actually quite a small number when you count how many molecules are actually loaded. It will be, I think nobody would argue with 100 molecules out of about 1 million would do it. And that certainly isn't enough to change the thermodynamic properties of your binding. So there's definitely a signaling component in there. And of course, this is also the this also brings in the cytoskeleton as well. So how do you signal to the cytoskeleton? How do you make it do that directed motion of your domains towards the center of the interface? So although we have lots of understanding of the bond length differences and the segregation which is associated with it, we cannot say that this is the mechanism. So what we would what we need is to be able to prove or disprove it. And so this is why I think we need to do some very careful quantitative analysis. For example, using those predictions of the Sharpe interface model to see whether it fits. So I will stop there. Thank you.
You mentioned actually that there's a particular critical size of your domain before they can grow or shrink. In Dan's experiment in the morning, the synapses actually shrunk. So is the kappa value for the case that he showed smaller than the critical value that you calculated? And other cases where they actually grow?
Well, I don't know exactly what kappa is. With the kappa I used, which was about 60 microns per meter, the minimum size was about 500 nanometers. So it would be smaller than those end images.
Smaller than the ones for that?
Yeah, yeah.
But you would expect them to grow, right?
No, I'd expect... No. I was talking about invasion.
Invasion?
Yeah, so formation of one. Presumably, if they shrunk too much, for example, through downregulation, eventually you'd reach a size where you couldn't sustain that anymore, and it would just collapse. So possibly that.
It wouldn't shrink below a size, because if it's above the size where it's sustained, it probably
grows. No, but if you're downregulating your TCR, you're losing.
There's no TCR downregulation.
No.
Of lots of interfaces that are charged surfaces have electricity, and a lot of molecules will interact in lots of different places to some degree.
Yeah.
So is it possible that
they're wrong?
See a whole spectrum of them, some with different strengths, and then interacting themselves close as they're first interacting, and you know, one given length is not stable and can fluctuate, they interact with other interfaces.
The short ones, the evidence is pretty good. The crystal structure, you know, there's problems with crystal structure, but accepting that, crystal structure suggests that they bind end on end, and the adhesion molecule is more difficult. You don't know that they will bind head on. You do know that LFA1 does have this two affinity state, and the conformational change there is known. It's folded up when it's low, and then it unfolds to release this binding site. So it seems pretty likely that that's standing up. I think it's the ICAM 1 is much more difficult because it's got immunoglobulin domains, and so you just the way the length is calculated is by assuming that they are just stretched out, and you just add it up. So that is the weakest point, but there is no solid evidence that it's 41 nanometers.
Just a question on scaling to sort of make the transition. But I'm unclear, because we talk about all these chemical bond lengths and why the synapse breaks up, but presumably they're incredibly weak, and if the cell decides just to walk away, it just rips them apart. Is that right? Or how do these scale in terms of, you know, cell motility or something?
I think an individual bond will be easy to break. But
but on the scale of the number of bonds that you have, is that relevant to a cell mechanically? If it
I think perhaps you should ask Darren and Byron. They've looked more closely at the adhesion model, because what they've basically done is an adhesion model.
Have you ever, like, calculated the sum of the
cell going to walk away? It's going to have to do something similar to something else. Well, no,
the cells migrate around the place just anyway, yeah. Along the...
What pushes
them? Their internal cytoskeleton, they rearrange.
No, you can't put a cell in water, it can't rearrange the cytoskeleton and swim.
Yeah, and
stick to something else somewhere else.
Right.
Pull the cell
in
that
cell.
Yeah,
they're going to stick. Well, no, it uses different adhesion molecules to stick to the collagen matrix than it does to these cells. So it might decide to migrate off out of the lymph node or whatever along the matrix.
Actually, I think
that
there's adhesion
molecules
pretty similar.
Well, they're a bit like intercellular signaling molecules. They're a lot similar. But I just wondered if you add up all that energy, you just walk away and push them all out.
But I think this is why there was this big argument between the two groups. Dustin see all these synapses for hours on end, and then this other guy, what's his name? Sorry? The guy who did the 3D collagen matrix, what was his name?
They didn't last long.
And I think that the way you resolve that is that the collagen matrix is giving it signals to move, and so
traction
and also signals to move, and so it stops because its balance has moved into the signals to stop have increased over and above those to move, and I think that's why synapses will break, is it's a balance between those two sets of signals.
Well, I mean, when a synapse forms, we're talking about signaling, you have to have the T cell receptor engaged with the peptide for a very long time to get the signal that you want. The order of 6 hours or something. So one signal, for example, is the production of cytokines. So the signal says make certain molecules, and then the T cell secretes those. And what you can do is that is downregulation, so you may not be able by fluorescence to see the T cell receptors, because the concentration kind of low. But if you come in and you say antibodies are something to block those bonds that are constantly opening and closing, once you block the bonds, then secretion stops, the genes turn off. And so you know, and so they sit there for 6 hours, and they have to sit for a long time for a lot of signals.
But on the sort of scaling things again, in a different system, and probably Rustin can comment more, but in this antigen-independent proliferation, you only have to simulate them for 2 hours. And now I think about it, they wash them and mechanically disrupt the binding of the cells. So clearly that's quite possible, just, you know, with washing to mechanically disrupt it. So it's interesting, just when you think about things on this molecular scale, what actually happens to the cells, whether we have to explain why they fall apart on a molecular level, or whether that's actually happening on another level of cellular mechanics we're talking about.
I mean, I think getting these cells apart has to be fairly active.
So, sometimes they stick and sometimes they move apart. I think they actually make a decision based on what they see.
But you can wash them apart, right?
In the experimental system in vitro, you take them, you put them on APCs, and then you take everything up on vortex machine, and they fall apart. But I don't think that says too much one way or the other, right?
Well, except that mechanical forces acting on the cell are quite significant compared to these bond forces. If you can mechanically disrupt it just with fluid flow, then the active migration of the cell on the matrix is likely to be much. It's a scaling question.
I have one more question. When you say a synapse actually is in a condition where it can grow, in the sense that your kappa is above this critical value, and then you also have segregation of the long and the short forms within a synapse, what grows on the outer edge? Is it the long form? Or if there's a short port, then you have to migrate all the way to the center.
What would you mean, grow?
What do you mean?
It was the domains. enrichment domains which were changing size, not the actual contact interface.
Okay, what do you mean by the enrichment?
These are the segregation domains, where the MHC is enriched at higher concentration. So shall I start my talk again?
We're going to switch back to one binder. I don't know, which are black ones? Is that the short ones?
Well, you're saying one of the domains, either the short ones or the long ones.
Yeah. I mean, there's an asymmetry somewhere that's set up by fluctuations. One of them tends to be in the C, and the other one tends to be the short, the actual discrete domains. And, I mean, it was just fluctuations in my case, but because they were identical, apart from bond length. But if you increase the concentration of one of the pairs, then that would tend to be the background.
The high concentration of the background?
The ones which will be able to form more bonds. It comes down to which one's area will be bigger. That's what it comes down to. And that's determined by the equality of this sum of the complexes.
I seem to remember that there was something that, you know, sometimes 30 or 40% of the total TCR or total MHC on the surface can be sucked into a synapse. Is that right? And if that's the case, these guys have got three. So that do you end up with this sort of?
These guys got three what?
You were showing these cells that were actually contacting. There was an APC
contacting
three other cells.
Yeah.
So do you end up with the dilutions of?
Presumably, yeah. Yeah.
Big synapses.
Yeah, it depends what's limiting. I mean,
it's practically null on the rest of the cell.
Yeah, but that's not true. You can still pick out the cell. Because, I mean, one of the problems with the analysis I showed is that I'm picking out the cell membrane position by using this fluorescence marker, which is localizing. And I shouldn't do that. I should use one which doesn't localize and then see if it correlates and compute the curvature with that so that I don't bias it, because the noise will be greater where it's lower. So
right.
So we have to redo that.
You showed this picture at the beginning of lots of black and white domain. How does that connect with what you're talking about now?
Very, very good question. So the prediction is that these domains will not coalesce. The caveat is, of course, that this characteristic length of the membrane, this B over tau rooted, must be small compared to the size of the interface. So why would you only see one domain in the middle? So there's two explanations. One is that this characteristic length is actually very big, so it's of the order of a micron, which means that you can't fit lots of domains inside that contact interface because that's about 10 microns across. You know, if your width of your domain wall is about a micron, you're not going to get very many in there. So that's one explanation. The other explanation is that the conclusion that the cytoskeleton isn't involved in these synapses is wrong. That actually there's been an active phase of aggregation to the middle. And I think it's the second one which is probably true, because you saw how tight that the change was, although it was in the fluorescence. So we still have to make sure that correlates with the actual change in the separation. So we can't definitively say at the moment how wide they are. But I think it will just be a couple of... Hopefully next month we will know.
Are there any examples where you can see these discrete domains?
Are there any experimental systems where people have actually seen these discrete domains?
Well, the CD2 system with that mutant, that's one. Okay, that's definitely got no cytoskeleton involvement, and you see these very discrete, quite small domains, although, you know, they are... Yeah, very first picture. It's a couple of microns across, so, and that's quite clear. Oh, the light's, you can't see it. I can see it very well on the screen. But you can see these holes, these holes. Of course you can fiddle that because you can just put a threshold. That's what they do with these images. They put a threshold on and say, wow, look, it's blank in the middle. So there's a slight bit of cheating there. But, you know, there's a red splodge here which corresponds to that guy there. And they do separate quite distinctly here. So that suggests to me that this is sharp profile. This is a sharp interface. I'm not sure about thymocytes. Thymocytes is the other place where people have said the cytoskeleton isn't involved. But from my understanding there, it is relatively large domains which are drifting through. So why are the domains so large? And I don't know.